So, I said last week that I kind of drew the short straw talking about the priesthood. Now we got this whole business of the ark. What does it mean? What does it mean for you? I know you want to make it applicable to you, and it is highly applicable. Because what we have to see first and foremost is what the ark is doing. What's going on in this story? What's the narrative? What's David trying to accomplish here? And what does the ark mean? I was thinking about this week, most people's understanding of the Ark is probably limited to Harrison Ford, Indiana Jones, and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is not bad. I mean, it's better that than Temple of Doom, because that was a horrible one. Sorry, it was. But Raiders of the Lost Ark, that's your only knowledge, if that's your only touch point for what the Ark is, that's okay. We'll expand on that a little bit tonight. First, David. We're finally to him. It's been a few weeks now. We've looked at the life of David, but from other characters' perspectives. And today we're going to look at the life of David through an object, the Ark, and what it means for him. And why is he trying to get it back to Jerusalem? What's the significance of it? See, David's life is very interesting for many reasons. It's some people say it's the longest recorded narrative of an individual life in all of ancient literature, not just the Bible. But in all of ancient literature, it's the longest one. It comprises two books of the Bible. God's got a lot to say about this guy, David, and his kingship. And the reason why we're focusing on David and this idea of a wounded life is because we see that through David's experiences, he produces this book of songs. Hold on one second. I underestimate how exactly hot it is up here with the spotlight. So fans coming back on for me, not for you. You can stay toasty. But this is like, these things are like ultra powered. I don't know what's going on. But when you see David's life, it's a wonderful story if you go through, because you see a guy who's real, a guy who's authentic, a guy who's got ups and downs, a guy who's got heartbreak and heartache, and a guy who's got fear and loss, a guy who makes a lot of dumb mistakes, does a lot of stupid things, does a lot of great things. And from that, of course, we said that he's out of his life's narrative, he's written most of the book of Psalms, these wonderful songs that you can open up now to. And it's like medicine for your soul sometimes. When you feel like you're at the bottom, when you feel like you're lost, when you feel like you have no hope, David's Psalms that came out of his real, authentic, wounded life give us wonderful inspiration, wonderful power. And here today, David is going after the ark. Now, what's happening here? The ark. I know it seems like an old box to you. I got it. And it was. It was just nothing more than probably a 4 foot long by 2.5 foot by 2.5 foot box. And in it, of course, you have the Ten Commandments from that Moses. You had Aaron's rod. You had a couple other things in there too, we believe. And you have to ask yourself, okay, what does the ark mean for me today? Why is David pursuing it with such vigor? And what is this whole business about Uzzah touching it and dying? We've got to get to that. It's very, very important. First, the ark. Here's what the ark was, and here's why it was so important. It was a box, yes, but it was so much more than that. It's described on there that they'd had angels that were engraved on the outside of this ornate ark of the covenant. And it wasn't just that they housed the Ten Commandments and the rod of Aaron, and that was important enough. Those are relics. Those are religious artifacts. But this was the most important part. Is that when the ark was in the wilderness with the Israelites, it went before them. It always went before them, and always resting on the ark was God's presence. They call it his Shekinah glory, his kabod, his weight, his literal significance. The ark, therefore, wasn't a religious artifact like you might think other religious artifacts are. I'll compare those in a little bit. But the ark was the very presence of God. It was the very dwelling place of God. Now, where does that fit into the context of the story? If you remember last week, you remember the two sons of Eli who were priests, Phinehas and Hophni, and they were bad dudes. They were stealing money. They were sleeping with the women who came to the church. They were corrupt and they were evil. And the people of Israel and Eli, their very own father, tolerated it. See, this was the point after Israel had gotten rid of its judges. And now they had a priest, but the priests were corrupt, and they didn't have a king to follow. They're almost like a nation just lost in the wilderness, literally, quite literally at times. But the ark, wherever the ark went, people knew That was where God was going. And if God leads, I can surely follow. See, the ark, it wasn't just a box, it was hope. It wasn't just a container, it was promise. It was presence, it was power. And they knew this, the people of Israel did. But here's what happens. Since the two boys of Eli are so corrupt, they figured that they hatch a good plan. They say, we'll take the ark into battle with us. Because they're remembering that in Israel's past, they took the ark and they ran it around the walls of Jericho and they came down, right? And the people said, well, surely wherever the ark goes, the strength of God goes before it. So therefore, we're safe. We can cart it out to battle and we'll win all the time. Yeah, not so much. Because Hophni and Phinehas, they take the ark and they take it into battle to the Philistines and they get decimated. It says about 30,000 people wiped clean. The people of Israel, of course, what are they going to think now? They say, wait a second. We have the ark. This is God. It's our trump card. Surely we'd win. We didn't win. We lost. And the Philistines take the ark, and they move it around city to city, and bad stuff happens. They're almost mocking it, saying, this is the ark of the God of Israel that was supposed to be so powerful, and yet we defeated them. The Israelites are crestfallen now. They're in despair. They lack hope. They lack direction and power and presence and authority. Their world has been rocked. And the Philistines take the ark, and they take it to their temple of Dagon, the corn god. They worship the god of corn because he was functional. And weird things happen. So when they put the ark in the temple, Dagon, the statue, it says they wake up the next morning, and Dagon, you can imagine this, he's face down, his statue's face down in front of the ark. That'd be kind of odd. So you probably think, like, what are some kids doing fooling around and moving the statue around? They shouldn't be doing that. So they pick up the statue and they put it back. They wake up the next morning and something even crazier has happened. The statue's there in its body, but its hands and its head are cut off in front of the ark. And hands and head in this time symbolized head for wisdom, hands for power. God's saying, I'm not playing around with you. Stop putting me in your temples. So the Philistines, they get smart. They say, ha ha, we'll do something better. We'll move them to Ashdod. We'll move them around the cities. And every place that they put the ark, people either die or they get what I just read as tumors, which actually, sorry to say this to be graphic, but the Hebrew word meter means really, really bad hemorrhoids, if you want to say that. I mean, it's kind of gross, but this is what they were doing. They were breaking out literally in pain and suffering. If they weren't dying, they were getting really sick. And so finally they say, get it away from us. Get it out of here. Send it back to the Israelites. And they do that, but then the Israelites, this is where Raiders of the Lost Ark was almost correct. It weren't Nazis, but the Israelites say, let's peek inside. I'm curious, what's inside this thing? They open it up, and they get wiped out. Depending upon your translation, some people say 70, some people say 50,000. We think it's closer to 70. But it was bad news for them. Why? Because it meant power. It meant presence. And the people who kept opening it and people who kept touching it didn't respect this. Now, the ark is the central character in this story. And now we come to the point in 2 Samuel, David the king, years have passed now. The ark hasn't been in the tabernacle. It hasn't been in the temple for about 20 years or so. Years have gone by. And David says, I want it back. Why? He knows something about the ark that we miss because we're modern folks. And I want to try to explain that today. Here's how I'm going to put it. For David and the ark, he's got a relationship to this object. And it's not just a mere object. It has a force on it. It has glory on it. It has God's glory, his presence. Where this thing goes, he goes. Where he is, you can worship. And David wants it back. Why? And I put it under three headings. You can follow in your outline if you want. He sees that there's a promise to the ark, but there's a problem, and there's a good gospel message to the ark. There's a promise, but there's a big old problem that we got to talk about. But then there's good news with the ark, and David wants it. Here's why. Okay, first, the promise. The promise of the ark, David knows, is that if he can get it and get it back to Jerusalem, all is right with the world. Peace, hope, power, the presence of God. Now the people can go into the temple and they know they'll meet God. They know it. They've been lost for years. And this thing has been floating around. And David knows something of this box, the ark. He knows if he gets it, that's all he'll ever, ever need in his life. All he needs truly is the presence of God. And this is why we believe that David writes Psalm 27 around this time. One thing have I asked of the Lord that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. What's he saying there? He's saying, if I got that, that's all I need. I need him for peace in my life. I need him for the power just to live. And the ark represents it because that's where the glory sits. It's called the mercy seat, and I'll explain why in a little bit. It's rather cool. See, the promise of the ark to David, he knows if he can get that, he's got God, and that's all he wants. One thing have I asked of the Lord that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. You know what he wants to do? He just wants to sit and stare at the ark and feel the glory of God, to know it. Because if you follow along David's life and we'll unpack it over the next few weeks, he's made a really hot mess of his life at this point. He's made some really bad decisions. He's going to make a lot more. And he knows without this presence of God, you can have all the head knowledge of him, but it doesn't make any transformation in your heart, David would argue. See, he knows the ark is out there somewhere. And that's a good thing to know. But he wants to experience it. He wants to taste it. Jonathan Edwards always gave this illustration, and I try to update it every once in a while. He says it's as if you know the difference. It's the difference between knowing that honey is sweet and tasting that it is sweet. See, I can tell you all about the sweetness of honey, can I not? Let me tell you, you know honey, but let me tell you about it. It's sweet. It's syrupy. It's warm sometimes. You could spread it on bread. Oh, it's so good and sweet. Have it with a cup of coffee. And now you're thinking about honey, and now you're getting hungry. I got it. But see, it's one thing entirely for me to tell you about the sweetness of honey. But then if I walked you next door and said, here, take, eat. Oh, it's entirely different. Your synapses start firing. If you like honey, your heart starts thumping if you really like honey. See, David had the knowledge of God, but he didn't yet have the experience of him. And he wanted it. He wanted it so bad that when they do get the ark and they screw up the directions about how to carry it, which I'll explain, he dances and he dances with joy. And he worships, it says, with cymbals and harps and lyres. And by the way, this is a good argument for contemporary worship in church. They had it back then. That was contemporary worship service. They're banging cymbals and dancing and looking crazy. Why? They got it. And it makes all the difference in the world. One thing have I asked. One thing that I seek. That I can gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and inquire in his temple. David, in essence, says, listen, I need it. I crave it. That's the promise. If you got the ark, you would get God and his glory and his weight and his love and his direction and his embrace. Because the ark was the center of that. That's where the very Shekinah glory came down and rested in a cloud. And it sat in the back room of the temple. And it was so powerful that only one person could go one time a year to offer sacrifices for the others. David wants something that sweet. He doesn't want to talk about honey anymore. He wants it dripping from his lips. You see, I'm pressing this out because what the promise of the ark means is this. It's saying, I'm going to go from head knowledge of God to a heart knowledge that transforms my life to give me joy, that makes me want to dance and sing and make a loud ruckus. That's the promise. But there's a problem. And if you read this passage, go back, what's this whole business of Uzzah? Nice name, right? Uzzah. They're carrying the ark, and they're loading it back, and they're saying, we got it now. And the ark starts to slip, it says, because the ox stumbled. And poor little Uzzah, innocent little Uzzah, reaches out his hand, and he touches the ark, and God strikes him dead. And here's where people, modern readers, have a real problem with the Bible. Modern readers, modern people would look at this and say, see, How can I believe in a God who so arbitrarily kills somebody just for sticking out their hand? There's a problem. Uzzah dies. David says he gets angry and scared. Now, when you look at this on face value, you say, well, Uzzah just touched it. What was the big deal? Oh, he broke a rule. So God smote him dead. And you say, well, pastor, is that the kind of God we worship, right? Break a rule, die. Follow the rules, get blessed. That's not really what he's doing here. See, here, the ark, because it had the presence of God that sat on it, that would come down in the temple, meant it was powerful, meant it was deadly, meant it was lethal to people like you and me, broken people. And because of that, in the book of Leviticus, there's rules that are established. How do you carry the ark? And every one of the rules is broken here. See, you're supposed to cover the ark with a cloth. It's not covered. You're supposed to carry it on poles, not on a cart. They put it on a cart, not poles. And you're not supposed to touch it. And of course, that's what Uzzah does. What's going on here? Why does this God seem so flippant? Why does this guy seem so rigid? And here's what he's trying to prove out here. See, the ark is not like any other artifact, religiously speaking. People, most of the time, for religious artifacts, if you are big into artifacts, you touch them. And they give you a blessing. They give you a feeling. I remember going on vacation to Italy, went to Rome. And, of course, you got to go, when you're in Rome, you got to see all the sights. And we went to St. Peter's Church, my brother and I, at the time. And I remember, if you've ever been there, there's the statue of Peter, the great Peter. And his foot's kind of like oddly sticking out, you know this? Not sticking out, but he kind of like leaning it forward. And people go and they rub his foot, rub his little toe, I think. I think that's on his right foot. And I thought, this is kind of weird, funky. Why would you go rub a guy's foot? So I inquired onto this such thing. And I found that actually, he's not the only one that people rub. See, religious artifacts, by and large, for every other faith, would say, touch me and I'll bless you. Touch me and I'll give you power. The ark says, you can't touch me because there's too much of a chasm between you and me. When Uzzah touches it, it's not just that he breaks a rule. He breaks a relationship. He takes for granted the power that's in there, and he assumes too much of himself. Let me put it this way, theologically speaking. Put yourself in Uzzah's position. The ark's falling over, and you think, if I let it touch the ground, it's going to get dirty and soiled, so I'm going to touch it with my hand. Now, theologically speaking, soil is okay, theologically speaking. It does what it's intended to do. You plant something in it, you put water, and it grows. It's theologically sound, soil is. Dirt does what it's supposed to do. But Uzzah's hand wasn't doing what it was supposed to do. And see, it's theologically, here's what commentators say. Uzzah touched it because he thought his hand was cleaner than the ground. He didn't know the length and weight and depth of sin in his own heart. He didn't know that the ark was too powerful for him to touch. See, this is the problem. The ark, every other artifact says, come and touch me and take my power. The ark says, I'll have none of it. I'm too high, too powerful, and you are too broken. Uzzah thought, if I can just touch it with my hand, I can help it. And God says, no, because you don't realize the great immense power and weight and glory that resides here. And they work this out in your relationship with God. God says this, I'm too big. Don't try to wrap your arms around me. Don't try to control me. Don't try to manipulate me. Don't try to use me. I'm not a tame God, he would say. See, this is the problem with the ark. It's not a tame God. God's not predictable. He's not manageable. I'll push it even further. As I said before, remember I said, all the people, the Israelites, they would take the ark and they'd take it out into battle and they always won. And they thought, surely we can do it again. Hophni and Phinehas say, let's take it out and we'll win. And they lost. What's going on here? God says, you don't control me. I don't march to your beat. You can't use me for your own gain. Yeah, I'm too powerful for that. My glory's too heavy. What he's saying is there's a chasm. There's a spiritual chasm, and this is the problem. This is what the ark exposes, the first part of the gospel, that you and I are more sinful than we ever thought possible. Uzzah didn't know his own heart. Uzzah thought his hand was cleaner than the ground, and it wasn't. See, that's what the ark has a problem in our lives. The ark exposes the first part of the gospel message, that you and I are too broken, too lost, too self-centered, too stained by sin to come into the very presence of God. Push it even further. This is why, as I said, the only one person, the high priest, could only go into the Holy of the Holies, the back room where the ark was, and only one time a year, and he had to come with a sacrifice. The problem of the ark is that it shows exactly the depth of the chasm between you and me and God. And like I said, that's the first part of the gospel, that you're more sinful than you ever, ever thought possible. But here's the good news. And David gets it by doing two things. David recognizes this problem, this chasm, but he also sees the provision of the ark. What do I mean by that? If you go back to 2 Samuel 6:9, David recognizes the chasm. He sees Uzzah strike dead, and he gets angry. But then he pauses and he thinks to himself and he says, "How can I then have the ark come to me, God?" What's he doing? He's starting to understand grace. He's starting to understand the need for grace in his life. He says, "If you're going to do that to him, I don't want any part of this. I can't handle this. No, you are not a God that's tame. I can't control you. I can't manipulate you like all the other idols and gods could be done to." David is first starting to understand the need for grace when he says, "How can I then have the ark come to me?" See, that's the first part of the gospel. Paul, in the book of Romans, he writes it this way. He says, "No one's righteous, not one," right? Not one. And David is starting to understand that. See, before, he wasn't carrying the ark the right way. He wasn't covering it. He wasn't following and giving it the respect and the awe and the admiration due because that was the very presence of God. And he thought, "I can own it. I can control it. I can carry it the way I want to carry it. I can touch it when I want to touch it." Now he sees the immense raw power. And it's like Mr. Beaver when he does say to the little girl, so when it says to Lucy, "No, he's not tame, but he's good. He's the king, I tell you." And David now sees, "No, he's not tame. And he never comes the same way twice. We thought we could bring him out to battle and we'd surely win, but we don't. Why? Because this is a God you don't use. This is a God who's not functional for you, first and foremost. He's a God to worship, to give awe and reverence and respect." So here, David does two things. First, he sees the chasm. He says, "How can the ark even come to somebody like me, little me?" Mind you, he's the king of all Israel. He has every right to say, "Yes, I'm the king. I deserve the ark." But he says, "No, look, now I see, probably for the first time, the chasm, the distance between that powerful God and sinful me." And he's shaken by that. But here's what he does. He leaves the ark with a guy named Obed. And this was, they call him the Obed the Gittite, which means he was a foreigner, probably living in Israel, but still a foreigner. Foreigner culturally, racially, religiously, most likely. And David, you could imagine this. He says, "Leave the ark at this guy's house." And you could say, could you imagine David walking away and going, "He's toast. He's done for. Everywhere this ark is gone, the immense power of God has been too much for people to handle. It's destroyed them because they thought they could control him and they can't." And you should see David probably leaving this at little Obed's house to get tight and saying, "Good luck with that, big guy. See you in 3 months if you're still here." And he goes away and 3 months go by and Obed's not stricken down. He's blessed. Here's what's going on. God is saying, "No, I work the way I work. You don't control me. You think that I'll strike him down, but I will bless him. I'll lift him up." See, it's grace. It's pure grace. It's grace alone. And David sees it. And David is shocked by this. How? When we tried to control God, when we thought we could touch this, and we were stricken dead. Now we leave it at this foreigner's house. And 3 months later, he's not dead. He's blessed. What's going on here? Grace. Grace alone. God is saying, I will choose whom I choose, how I choose. I don't choose the ones you think I ought to choose. I bless those I bless. It's by grace alone that he does this. And this is the second part of the gospel. If the first part is David recognizing, how can the ark come to me? What he's saying is, I'm more sinful than I ever thought possible. But now he sees that God is infinitely more gracious than we ever dared imagined or believed. Because he works on his timetable, in his way, by grace and grace alone. He says, I'll bless this guy, the least likely candidate. You saw this last week, when he chooses Samuel over Eli. He chooses the little one over the old and venerated. He chooses the poor over the guy who's well-respected and been in the job the longest. Why? Because he says, God is saying, this is the pattern in which I work. I choose those at the bottom to bring it to the top. I choose the ones least likely to, and I bless them. David starts to see the gospel, and it's really, really awesome. Like I said, and I've been repeating this, the ark, when it does get put in the tabernacle, only one person can go once a year to go into that place, into the very presence of God, because it's too powerful for anybody else. But here's the condition. When you went in, you had to take something of a sacrifice. You had to pay it down. You had to pay the cost of the sins of all the other people in the community. And you might say that doesn't sound fair. And you might say, well, what kind of a God is this? What kind of a tyrant God demands a sacrifice to forgive? Why can't he just reside on the park and ark with his presence? Why can't he just come there and forgive everybody and bless them all? Why does it only have to go one person, one time with a sacrifice? And if you say that and you think it's not fair, then brothers and sisters, you have not really been wronged in your life, I would imagine. Because when you're wronged, when you're really, really wronged, there's a cost that needs to be paid. When you and I are hurt by somebody else, you know this, and it's a deep hurt, and it's a deep wound, and there's pain, and there's hurt, and tragedy. Somebody betrays you, somebody lies to you, somebody mistreats you very, very wrongly, and they cut to your core. There's a cost. You can forgive them, but you'll be paying the cost. Or you can hold a grudge, and they'll pay the cost. But a cost exists nonetheless. You see, this is what the Holy of Holies is. This is what the ark means for you. There is a problem with our lives. There is a chasm. But it was broached. Back then, it was broached one time a year on Yom Kippur. And the sacrifices of blood and goats. And the writer of Hebrews talks about this in chapter 9. And he gives this lengthy disposition, a monologue on the old tent and the old temple and how the priest would go in there and sacrifice bulls and goats for the people to forgive them, to atone for them, because he knows there's a cost. The chasm must be breached. There's got to be a bridge. There's got to be something that atones for us. And the writer of Hebrews goes through great lengths to explain this from the Old Testament. But then he does something cool. He says this. But Christ came as a chief priest of the good things that are now here. Christ went through a better, more perfect tent that was not made by human hands and is not part of this created world. He used his own blood, not the blood of goats and bulls for the sacrifice. He went into the most holy place and offered this sacrifice once and for all to free us forever. The blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of cows sprinkled on unclean people made their bodies holy and clean. The blood of Christ, who had no defect, does even more. Through the eternal Spirit, he offered himself to God, and now we can serve the living God. Here's what the ark means for you today. It means God drew near to you. You get his power. You get the presence, not death. Go into the Holy of Holies one time, and you're stricken dead. Touch it like Uzzah. You're dead. He says, I'm too big for you, but I'll pay the cost down. See, when you get hurt or you hurt someone, like I said, you got to pay that cost. You forgive them, you'll eat the cost of the hurt. If you hold a grudge against them, they pay the cost, and you'll be banking them pay it down day in and day out. You'll make them grovel. How much more than the Lord of the universe? How much of a cost does he have to pay to bring you and me back? And he does it. And on the ark, he says, now you get me. The writer of Hebrews says, back in the day, they put the ark in the tent and only one person could go back. Don't you see now? That sacrifice just pointed to the true sacrifice, Jesus Christ, for you and me. Yes, there is a chasm. There is a problem. He's not a tame God, but he's a good one. He's the king, I tell you. And it's Jesus who pays that cost. Now, what's the result of this story as I close? How do you apply this? There's the gospel. That's all it is. The chasm exists. Touch it. Die. God says, I'll come near so that you live. And you get me. And you can taste me like that honey, not just think about me. And what does it do to your life? Or what does it ought to do? Look at David. The part we didn't read. Sometime go back if you can, tonight or tomorrow. Go back in 2 Samuel at the end of chapter 6 and look what's happening to David. It's something really funny. At least it's funny to me. I don't know if you'll find this funny. He's dancing again. He's dancing. He's leaping for joy up and down. And he's wearing a linen ephod. You remember that from last week? The linen ephod was the sign of humility. David finally gets it. He finally gets the depth between him and God, but that it'll be bridged by a sacrifice. And the bulls and the goats are only temporary. They lead to the one, Jesus Christ. Now you and me, on the other side of the cross, get to know that Jesus did that for us. What should it do for you? Joy. Joy. Do you dance? Do you scream out? Let me push this even further to wrap up this story. David's dancing with the women. Scandalous. And Saul's daughter in that story, Michal, comes down and says, how stupid of you. The king, looking like an idiot, basically, dancing with these women. And, I've asked many of you to come up and read scripture at times before I preach. And I do that because I know you get tired of hearing my voice and you want to hear other people talk. And it's nice to have people do that. So please volunteer. But I know it's hard for people to get up here and to look out there and to read scripture. And I know it's even harder sometimes when I've asked people, can you pray after reading scripture? And they get mortified. Pray in front of people? And that's fine. That's fair. No judging. Okay. Now, if you're slightly embarrassed to get up here and read, and you're even more embarrassed to get up here and pray, what if I asked you to come up here right now and dance? You're scared, right? I'm about to ask one of you guys to do it. No, I'm not. I'm just kidding. Take a breath. But if I did, oh, how embarrassing that would be. And this is exactly what David is doing. He looks like an idiot to everybody, but he doesn't care. And here's what he says to Michal. She comes down and says, it's scandalous that you're dancing with these women and that you're wearing this little linen ephod. You're the king, for Pete's sake. Have more respect. And David says, I don't care. He says, I didn't dance in front of the slave girls, but in front of the Lord. He chose me rather than your father or anyone in your father's house, and he appointed me leader of Israel, the Lord's people. I will celebrate in the Lord's presence. Do you see what the ark does? If you know, not just in your head about the honey, but you can taste it. If you know, not just in your head about Jesus, but you can taste it. You know what he did for you. You dance. You'll dance when nobody's around you. You'll dance as look like a complete idiot in your life. You have joy. David has this joy. And he says, you can't touch it because he chose me by grace. And I'm going to dance. And I'm going to sing. And I don't care what you think. You see, for the first time, perhaps in all of David's life, he was free from the judgment of others. He was free from others' opinions. He was free from others' scandalous comments and accusations. He was free, he says, and I will celebrate in the Lord's presence. Brothers and sisters, tonight the ark means that for you and me. It means you get it. The chasm's been covered. The blood's been spilled. Take it. Taste it. It's sweet. And it'll make you dance. And you'll say, I don't care. I will celebrate in the Lord's presence. Go in prayer now. Reflect on this in silence. What does it mean that you have access to the Holy of Holies now?